Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me for this, which is our mailbag episode for the season finale, or the series finale of The X-Files, Chris Carter's My Struggle 4. And it's a pleasure as ever to be joined on the X-Cast by Chris Knowles. Hey, Chris.
Hey, good to see you. Or not see you.
Good to talk to you again. And let's just dive straight in. My Struggle 4. Overall impressions on it, please, from you, Chris.
Loved it. I've watched it three times, and my best impression came from the third watching. You know, when I had a chance to sort of process all the imagery and whatnot. But I just think it was just mad genius. Just sort of blow it up and start over again. You know, I'll be honest here. I really have not been a fan of the My Struggles at all. And I was really dreading this episode because I just thought it was just going to be another, people just sitting around in rooms talking about things going on that we never see and will never see. And I think it's just sort of it reminds me of a writer just struggling with a manuscript and then just deciding to just rip it up and throw it away and just start scratch. And there was just this sort of mad abandon to the whole proceedings that I just found so refreshing and, just so classic X-Files. I mean, I was surprised. And how long has it been since I've really been surprised by this show?
Well, you used the word mad there a couple of times. And I think this is one of the most delirious episodes I've seen of anything in a long time. And on its own terms, I thought, it was highly enjoyable. And generally, I thought it worked very well. I mean, I do think there are a couple of big missteps in here, which we'll get to in the fullness of time. But yeah, let's head into the feedback then. So we've had tons of people come back to me on Facebook and Twitter. I can't possibly read everyone's out, but thanks for everyone who got in touch. I'll hold some comments back for a future podcast, I think. But it really is a genuinely mixed bag. I mean, reaction was kind of all over the place on this one. I like to start on a positive note. So the first person to get in touch with me was Adam Silver on Facebook, and he said, "It was awesome, truly exciting and emotional, best of the season by far, and a perfect cap to the My Struggle arc. Chris Carter knocked it out of the park with his directing here. I just found it truly thrilling in a way that no other revival episode has been for me. Certain things were frustrating, of course, such as Skinner's and Reyes' apparent but unconfirmed deaths, the possibility that the Smoking Man is still alive, and the umpteenth closure of the X-Files. But it was a good ending for Mulder and Scully and sets up a potential continuation with William. Overall, I'm fine with this being the last episode of the series, if that's what it is. That's all I could ask for." So a couple of things I wanted to pick up on from Adam there. First of all, I mean, yeah, the last episode of the series. I mean, do you think this works better as a season finale or a series finale? How are you sort of taking it?
I like it as a series finale. I don't think they should continue. I don't think they will continue. I think it would be a bad idea to continue. I just think that what we saw, there's this whole talk about, oh, things got to be resolved and things got to be wrapped up. And it's just like, that never works. That never, I mean, it certainly doesn't work with the series. Well, with the exception of Existence. I mean, I think that in Carter's mind that he sort of wrapped up the Mulder Scully story with Existence. And I think, did a great job with it. I mean, wrapped it up beautifully. But it was sort of in that hothouse of the season 8 flame wars on the internet and just the whole controversy and all that kind of thing. I thought the story, you can put a cap on the story at that point. And after that, I mean, it's just like you're just sort of going back and recovering old ground. I mean, it's very difficult for a writer to handle. And, in this instance, I think that the way he just said, "I've given the fans everything that they've wanted over the years. It's never done me any good. I'm just going to do what I want and just blow it up,
Yeah, and I mean, like you say about wrapping everything up, I mean, we've had one very join the dots series finale in the past, haven't we, in The Truth? And
I totally agree with you, and that was an endurance test, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I much prefer something like this, which was kind of wild, and untamed almost. So Adam also mentions his directing, and I really do want to pick up on this because it's not always the kind of thing people pick up on, but I think Carter's an exceptionally strong director. And I thought of the My Struggles, this was the strongest visually of the bunch,
Oh, I thought it was hypnotic. Carter has a real sense of poetry in a visual sense. I mean, there are certain criticisms you can make of his direction, you know, maybe choices about pacing and whatnot. But he has an amazing visual eye, you know, particularly in as far as it goes to filling up a television screen. This episode reminded me almost of a Terrence Malick film in some ways. It just had that kind of grandeur of nature sort of overlording this human drama on the ground. It just had a sense that he was really utilizing the savage beauty of Vancouver in winter to his advantage here.
Yeah, and like what I think he's got is like a real knack for like framing and composition. And I think I like My Struggle 2 a little bit more than you do. And one of the reasons is like there are some of his best compositions in there. They don't really register though because the episode is so rapidly like edited. But here, I don't know, they just had a bit more time to breathe, I felt, at the same time as the episode was kind of very propulsive, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I think that this was something that we haven't really seen too much of on the X-Files, and that's just sort of flat out action. And I really appreciate it because, like I said, it was different. It was a change. I mean, let's face it, after 25 years, we've pretty much seen it all with this series, and Carter gave us something genuinely new, and people are having trouble processing it. I think that's pretty much how it goes.
Yeah, well, let's get more into the action after this comment from Paige Schechter from your neck of the woods, I think, Chris, also from New Jersey. And she says, it was a hot mess. When David Duchovny said this one was for the fans, did he mean Mulder going all Jason Bourne and blasting everyone whose answers he didn't like? Did he mean the ridiculous twist of the 54-year-old barren woman pregnant again? Or was that just to make up for the fact William wasn't Mulder's? The apparent deaths of Reyes and Skinner weren't for the fans because not enough absolution was given to the forthright Monica and who wants Walter dead? We can't actually believe CSM was dead after we saw him eviscerated in the truth and he was just shot in the chest and pushed into the drink here. If anyone needed to have his head popped like a grape by William's newfound powers, it was CSM. So it didn't seem so much for the fans, but that's okay, it was their story to tell. The final shots were the finest possible end to it all for me. Mulder and Scully were in each other's arms, and a far bigger danger than an old man lurks in the water below. Let's get back to the pregnancy slightly later, but she mentions like Mulder, the action star, as you just did. And I don't really know if this was the intent or not. But it almost seemed like they were kind of exploring, if the series was to continue, this almost serves as a test case for like the viability of Duchovny as like a modern day action star, you know, all that stuff with Mr. Y and his goons and so on. And I enjoyed like the kinetic energy of those sequences. And I thought Duchovny looks credible here in a way perhaps he didn't even in season 10, really.
I thought he did a great job. I think he's a very credible action star. He's a very physical person. He's very athletic. He always has been very athletic. There's a great story about the filming of the Erlenmeyer flask when they had to sort of film him running, and they had to like, they tried like a golf cart and he outran the golf cart, and you know, they tried this and they tried that, and finally they just got on the back of a pickup truck because that was the only thing that he couldn't outrun. So I think that his physicality has been underused. We've seen glimmers of his violence, his propensity for violence. So, I mean, as far back as Anasazi. So I think that this shock of Mulder being physically violent when his back is basically to the wall, as it is in this story, I think is a little disingenuous, to be honest with you. I think that we've seen examples of his physicality. We've seen examples of his propensity for physical violence when put under pressure. So I don't think that's as much of a break with precedent as some people are making it out to be on the internet.
Yeah, and don't we even see it earlier? Don't we see him like go off on Dwayne Barry at one point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he has. I mean, that's the thing that I really like about this character traditionally, is that he's a very complex character, and this violent temper that we see emerge on occasion, I think it's something people tend to overlook.
Which is a shame, because it like figures into some really like powerful stuff, like in Paper Hearts as well, for example. Yeah, let's press on. So yeah, the baby element I wanted to pick up on. And Katie Doe says, just on the baby element, there were hints and foreshadowing, but I thought the show couldn't possibly be going in a miracle baby direction again. I felt like all the air was let out of me when Scully told Mulder that he was a father. I'm just so tired of the TV trope of what can we do with this female character that's dramatic. I know, we'll make her pregnant and then make it as difficult and traumatic as possible. I've never been comfortable with Scully's self-worth being defined by if she is a mother, and her character change in season 9 because of it was tough to watch. Mulder's sudden view of himself as having no identity, if not a father, didn't sit well either. More miracle babies, more fascination with women's seemingly mysterious reproductive systems. I'm just tired of it, and it's hard to put into words, but I find it somewhat insulting, and as a storyline, it's been done. That time has passed. They are older now, and they've been through this continuous traumatic experience since before William was born. Let them just be, to grieve and heal, and to come to terms with this new truth. Okay, so when I said I thought there were a couple of big missteps, I'm not massively in favor of this new Scully pregnancy either, to be honest. But, I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, I mean, pregnancy is at the core of the series. I mean, let's, you know, in a real-life pregnancy, in Gillian Anderson's case. So I think it's baked into the DNA. Is it my favorite plot twist ever? Not really, but, you know, I mean, we're dealing with the core themes of the series, which have always been about reproduction and childhood and parentage and mysterious parentage. I mean, all these things have been hard baked even into so many of the standalones. So do I think it just like dropped out of the sky? No, I mean, it's like the whole premise with Scully. I mean, I don't believe that Scully is actually barren. I think that her fertility was restored during the sixth extinction. And I think that, you know, when we see the fish coming to alive in the bag with Dr. Barnes there, I think that's a pretty clear indication. You know, that's basically as an explicit an acknowledgement as we're going to get. I think that her fertility was restored by the sixth extinction experience. I don't think she's barren. And I think that, you know, there's this whole through line that she's infested with alien DNA, you know, from her previous experiences. So, I mean, is it like something that just dropped out of the sky? You know, not really. But is it my favorite? You know, not really either. But I'm not offended by it, you know, because like I'm a parent, I'm a father. So, I mean, I appreciate anything that has to do with kids, you know? So.
Yeah. And I wanted to get your take on like Carter's intent with that twist. Cause I mean, a lot of the reaction has been on whether the viewers liked it or not. And, what do you think he was striving for there? Because I don't know, it almost seems like, you know, whenever it comes to ending the series, you know, we had the miracle announcement of the pregnancy in Requiem, then the birth in Existence, and now the second pregnancy. So I don't know, he almost seems to have this kind of really earnest, like, faith in, like, the transformative, like, I don't know, power of love or something, which I think in some ways it comes off as kind of old-fashioned. But, I mean, how exactly do you see it?
Well, I mean, you would hope it's not old-fashioned because it's, you know, the basis of all human continuity. I think with what Carter was doing in some ways, but he was just trying to revisit, you know, his idea of wrapping things up and coming full circle is just sort of revisiting ideas and visuals that, you know, he had touched upon in the past. And I think the fact that that sort of brought us back to Requiem, you know, like full circle in a sense. And then it ends with that scene lifted directly from Erlenmeyer Flask. I think that that was sort of his intent. But I also think that this is his way of saying that what the series is really about is that it's really about, like, you know, the drama of life and the drama of the continuity of life, the drama of so many monsters and characters wishing to perpetuate the line. You know, I mean, the classic example of this is Terms of Endearment, you know, with a demon trying to have a normal baby. So I think that this is part of the essential DNA of the X-Files. And I think that a lot of fans, you know, particularly shipper type fans, just want this to be like a cross between, you know, Moonlighting and, you know, maybe a soap opera or something or whatever. But I mean, you know, that's really, I think that's very self-centered and it really ignores the fact. I mean, I know that fans online like to see themselves as the center of the X-Files universe. And I think that the studio and Chris Carter and so on play into this. But online fandom is such a minuscule section of the overall X-Files viewership. And so many of the X-Files viewers, like normies, so to speak, that I've spoken to over the years. I mean, like, for instance, so many of them hate the comedy episodes. You know what I'm saying? So many of them are much more oriented towards the mythology because they're wrapped up in this whole big mystery than the online fans who tend to be geeks, who tend to be like comic book readers and things like that. And they're more geared towards Monster of the Week stuff. So I think that there's sort of a split in that sense. So, I mean, you have to just sort of realize that this whole idea of parentage and children and family is really just such a major part of the X-Files appeal outside of fandom, outside of the online world, outside of Tumblr and Twitter and all these places.
I agree, incidentally, on the comedy episodes, because I watch with a couple of normies, and when we watched Forehead Sweat, they were kind of like, you know, why would you come back and do 10 episodes and devote one to something like that, you know, which is obviously not the way people like us take it. So, yeah, I think that's a valid point.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Forehead Sweat was like God. I mean, I thought it was like, I was like having flashbacks. I'm like, oh my God, this is 1997 again. I mean, and I'll tell you something. I've made no mistake, bones about this, but I really, really hated Weremonster.
I
thought it was awful. And this is like, oh yeah, Darren Morgan, real Darren Morgan. I mean, it was just like Godhead to me. But it's just amazing to me, like, just people who I talk to, like members of my family or friends or just acquaintances, whoever, you know, who aren't really like hardcore X-Files fans, but watch the whole series in some regards. And they're just like, why do they do these stupid comedy things? It just doesn't make any sense. You know, they want to know, they're always like, what's happening with the aliens? What's happening with the aliens? So it's just like a major split in these two worlds that is almost irreconcilable in some senses.
And anyway, you mentioned the Erlenmeyer flask, and this next comment also refers to it. And it's from Edin Dumasic, who said, I really appreciate how the final image of My Struggle 4 goes full circle with the original mythology. So the first time we learn of and see hybrids in the X-Files is in Erlenmeyer Flask. And William emerging from the water is a clear nod to that episode when Dr. Sikaire, the first hybrid we meet, emerges from the water after being shot. William is the culmination of decades worth of work and research into hybrids, as My Struggle 4 is the culmination of 25 years of the X-Files mythology. Not only do we get a clear visual nod to Erlenmeyer Flask, we also see CSM shooting his son, point blank, as he did to Spender in Two Fathers, One Son, episodes that were to end that original mythology, whose titles referred to Mulder and his two fathers. Those same titles can now be applied to William. He is the one son born of two fathers, and he is the first organic hybrid, the true next step in evolution after Cassandra Spender. Talk about your sins of the fathers circles closing. Yes, yeah, so I really like that comment, and I also like the nods to like non-myth arc episodes, like the DPO kind of scene we see in the teaser with William. I thought that was a very nice touch too.
This is the thing that people just don't get about this episode. and let me just give you a bit of background. I mean, this is speculation. This is just sort of my interpretation. See, I've always thought, and looking at the history, I think it bears it out, that Carter really isn't as invested in the mythology as people tend to believe he is. I mean, he really sort of handed off the mythology office, so to speak, to Frank Spotnitz, basically after Paperclip. Frank was very much involved, you know, as early, of course, as Colony. But, he got busy with Millennium, developing Millennium and all these other things that were going on. They started talking about the movie at that point in time. I mean, you know, he was very busy. So he just sort of said, you know, you be the driving force in this. I like your sensibility. I don't think Chris was as invested in, you know, this whole 3 to 6 era. And I think he was more invested in, like, it's the season 8. I think Chris Carter was very much involved in the season 8 mythology, because it was kind of like starting from scratch. I mean, I think he always sort of wanted to start from scratch. But I think with this whole My Struggle thing, I think that when, you know, they resigned, you know, everybody to do this, I think Fox sort of said, you know, you've got to do this mythology. It's a big part of the fandom outside of, you know, online fandom, of course. You know, we really got to keep this going. And I think he just didn't really, you know, he had a lot of ideas, but I don't think he just really had a sense of what he wanted to say. And that's why, you know, those first three My Struggles are so disjointed and so just chaotic. And I think what he finally, you know, landed on is sort of reversing what Jim Wong had done with Founder's Mutation and with Ghoulie. And what he did here, and I think it's what people just are not getting, is that he took a mythology episode and turned it into a Monster of the Week. And, you know, sort of the punchline to Mulder and Scully's quest for the truth is that their own son has become a Monster of the Week. And if you watch that episode again, without prejudice, without preconception, what you're really seeing is sort of like a classic season 3 to 5, you know, Vancouver, troubled teen monster of the week. You know, DPO is a great example. Schizogeny is like not a great example, but an example. Yeah. You know, I mean, just all these sort of episodes along these lines. And I think that's, I think what he's sort of cluing us into with that call out to DPO. That's what I really appreciate about this. It's just sort of like taking something that just becomes so unwieldy and just so unsolvable, really, and boiling it down to like, okay, well, this is the punchline. It's like they were trying to fight this conspiracy, but they became like, you know, the product, the ultimate products of it, and the ultimate culmination of it in some ways.
And like, I don't know about you, I like the way the episode like dismantles some of the elements introduced, because like My Struggle 3 seems to set new things up in motion, doesn't it? So we get Mr. Y and Erica, and then Mr. Y is taken out, and then Academy Award nominee Barbara Hershey turns up for one line, and her head explodes. And
I love that.
I loved it.
It was great, because it's just like, well, you know, that's classic Carter, though. It's like sharp left turn, you know. So I, you know, everybody's like, well, let's continue on with the storyline. Do you really want to hear what these people have to say? It's just going to be some sort of reiteration of something that, you know, the syndicate character said in a much more compelling and timely way than these people would ever would. It's just like, I'll just kill them. You know, it's just like, it's a fake out. It's great.
Yeah, I thought it was really entertaining. And like, I enjoyed the way it kind of, I don't know if clarity is the right word exactly. It kind of streamlined things in a way, which I thought was effective. We'll come back to William's monstrosity, because it comes up again in a future comment. But I want to talk a little bit more about Scully. So Cortland Waters Bartley said, honestly, my initial reaction is that it could have been worse. I think that was the perfect sort of cliffhanger to end with, given that the future of the show is uncertain. It is open enough for future interpretation, but closed enough to feel like we're not completely at loss for what comes next. Still, I am not particularly pleased that Scully was given so little time in the episode and even less to do. Even if the show comes back, it doesn't seem likely we'll see Scully again, and this wasn't much of a send-off in terms of her contribution. So, as we all know, it seems, you know, Gillian Anderson appears to be done with the role, doesn't want to come back, even if the show did. Yeah, I mean, I felt the same way, but it wasn't much of a, you know, last hurrah for Scully. She kind of sits by the phone. She does get a nice bit investigative beat where she's the one who puts together the lotto, you know, the lotto anomaly or whatever. And then she turns up for the finale, but I don't like how we didn't see her reaction to Skinner. We didn't hear that exchange. I mean, what did you make of it? How did you see, like, Scully's role here?
Well, there's, like, sort of in-universe and out-universe interpretations here. You know, as far as, like, out-of-universe, the real world, I mean, when you announce at a public forum or convention or whatever, I forget exactly where it was announced, you know, 2 months before the final episode is shot that you're quitting the show, you really can't, like, expect a great deal of, like, screen time thereafter. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we know that My Struggle 4 was shot in December, and she had made this big announcement that sort of really, I think, really crippled the show. I think it crippled interest in the show. It just really took the legs out from underneath it. I think that was not, you know, like a sort of like stand-up move on her part. You know, she should have really done so at the end of the series and not like 3 months before the series had even gone to air. That announcement really hurt the show. I think that really poisoned, you know, sort of the usual suspects against her online and against the show, I mean, on her behalf. And, you know, I mean, what are you going to expect? I mean, do you think producers are going to sort of bend over backwards to accommodate you when you've really sort of undermined them? I don't think that's really, I don't think that's necessarily reasonable. But in in-universe sense, I thought that she's much more pivotal than people are giving her credit for, because she is the conduit between William and Mulder. I mean, she is sort of the intermediary. She is the messenger. At this point in the show, she's in near constant contact with William. So I think that when we hears these revelations, you know, from Skinner, for instance, and then the revelation at the end that, you know, that he's allegedly dead. And I know some fans have made comment about this. She's like, he's not dead. I'm, you know, he's talking to me right now in my head. It's driving me kind of nuts. So I think that at that point in time, she realizes that William is a monster. I mean, William is a monster. I mean, William is like the joke of this, again, is that he is the most dangerous monster the X-Files has ever seen. You know what I'm saying? He is the worst threat, the worst monster. And he's like inside her head. So I think that was a sort of a brilliant way for Chris Carter to sort of square the two circles. You know, square the circles, I mean, that David is the loyal soldier here, so he deserves more screen time. He deserves more action. Jillian is the one who's basically undercut the success of the series, and she gets less screen time. But at the same time, because of, you know, his loyalty to her and her contribution to the show, she gets this very interesting and complex sort of storyline within this episode that I thought was fascinating. I mean, you know, when we're seeing all these psychic flashes, I mean, that's through her point of view. So she's almost like, I mean, she's almost become herself kind of an X-Files monster, because she is now like this super psychic who's the only person who can actually communicate with this incredibly dangerous threat that they've created, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, how did you see this? Because there's another like camera move into Scully's eye about midway through this episode, isn't there? I mean, I would hope it wasn't going to be two seasons running that most of the episode takes place inside her head. I mean, I don't think Carter would be doing that, would he?
Well, no, I think that's the signal that William is sort of swooping in from the ether and invading her consciousness. Because, you know, it's always like kind of like a zoom, you know, it's always like whoosh, and there's her eye. I think that's the point there, is that what we're seeing is we're seeing William's consciousness sort of take hold of her. And then that's the signal.
Yeah, and let me just check what you thought of this. So, like, we have that shot, don't we, of her stood in front of the mirror, and it seemed to be reminiscent of a shot from Within to me. So do we take that to be the moment she sort of realizes she's pregnant? Is that how you saw it?
I'd have to rewatch that. I don't know if I picked up on that. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. And again, it's, you know, it's sort of consonant what we're discussing about Carter just revisiting greatest hits from previous episodes. So.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I couldn't work out why, you know, a story reason why she didn't want to go at the beginning of the episode. I was just a bit confused, that's all. Seeing as we've touched on William as a monster, let's hear from Bethany Good. I mean, this is just part of her message, but in general, she liked this episode. And she said, Mulder and William were paralleled throughout the episode in their actions and mannerisms. Both go on killing sprees. Both are seen running on rooftops and factories wearing similar clothing. When William meets with Sarah, the intensity of their exchange calls back to many of Mulder and Scully's scenes in body language and blocking. They are mirrored again at the end when William masquerades as Mulder before being shot. I love Mulder in this episode as he shows his tracking and investigative skills whilst looking for William. It's not long before he catches up to him. Mulder almost channels Liam Neeson's character from the Taken movies. This shows what a protective father he is. He's in full take-no-prisoners mode, and I really love it. William is also seen as not only an outsider, but also a monster. Very much Frankenstein's monster, with CSM being the mad Dr. Frankenstein. This illusion is consistently referenced throughout Carter's scripts. Nice continuity. And yeah, I mean, we know Frankenstein's been a bit of a touchstone for Carter in the past. I mean, if somebody had only seen The X-Files in season 11, I guess you would think of CSM as like this Dr. Frankenstein type figure, wouldn't you, from the way he's talked in these last few episodes?
Well, let me tell you my interpretation of what she's referring to here, because I think that's Carter saying that, yeah, that this is his actual father. I mean, Carter is always like, he's got this whole, like, I'm constantly pulling rabbits out of the hat, you know, and so, you know, it can get really tiresome after a while. But, you know, that's really, again, one of the central facets of the X-Files appeal, is that it didn't go in the usual direction that most television shows would go. And I think that's a through line from the very beginning of the series. I think that's Carter saying, they, you know, this is father and son. I my interpretation, and of course I could be totally wrong, because I was pretty much totally wrong about this entire series, because I made the mistake of going to precedent to make my interpretations. But I think that what is going on here is that Mulder is the biological father of William. Scully is the mother. And I think what happened with
Smoking Man,
exactly. Yes, sorry, I'm just blanked out there. Yeah, Smoking Man. You know that guy? I think he was in an episode or two. I think what happened with Smoking Man is that he just sort of, you know, because he had Scully and Mulder under constant surveillance, he saw that they were doing the deed at that point in the series, and decided to intervene and genetically engineer the zygote or the fetus or whatever stage William might have been at that point in time. I mean, you know, personally, I think that Carter is in exactly what she's referring to, is that Carter is signaling that this is father and son, and that this whole thing with the Smoking Man is, you know, not entirely true. And that's why we see that legend at the beginning of the episode or at the end of the credits, you know, I want to lie.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I think that, you know, he sees himself as William's father because he manipulated the DNA, which was already sort of, you know, humming with alien genetics to begin with. And that's why he sees himself as the father.
I mean, let's stick on this monster thing, because like, I thought there was a really interesting quote in Ghoulie. It just kind of passed me by at the time, but it's when Mulder and Scully are in the coffee shop and they're looking at the Ghoulie site, and Mulder says, hey, you know, monsters these days don't have any pathos, you know, whatever. And I really like Hero. Like, he does seem, Carter, to invert some aspects of the Frankenstein story. So, like, CSM's elderly, obviously. Victor Frankenstein was a young man, I think. William doesn't have, like, the physical marks of being a monster externally. It's all internal, isn't it? Because I really like that shot in the teaser where he kind of stamps his foot and the glass shatters, you know. This kind of, like, visual motif reflecting his, like, internal fracture. I mean, you've already highlighted this, but I liked the way, ultimately, instead of being, like, you know, let's stop the virus getting out or whatever, it came down to kind of a cat and mouse thing. And I thought, in some ways, that was the most effective part of the episode, the sort of search for William and all the William stuff, really.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I, like I said, I mean, I was really dreading just a slog through this, just sort of half-conceived new mythology, you know, Crypto Redux Part 7 or whatever the hell, I mean, you're talking about. I just was like, oh, God, don't do this to us. I was just, I mean, I was literally just like, you know, I was watching all these episodes throughout the season. I was like, oh, this is great, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's always like you had this sort of Damocles hanging over you at the end. And I was just so stunned. I mean, I was literally stunned. I mean, it's the first time I've been stunned by an X-Files episode. And I can't even remember how long. So, you know, maybe people don't like that. You know, people like things that are familiar. And that's not what I watched X-Files for.
In terms of, like, what Carter's been saying in interviews this week, and, you know, he's been saying people should watch the four parts of the struggles together. They all form parts of the whole and so on. And to be honest, I think you'd be much better off doing a double bill with Ghoulie and My Struggle 4. I was pleasantly surprised how much of Ghoulie, even down to the two girlfriends and everything, played back into this episode, you know, because I think Ghoulie and My Struggle are easily the strongest, like, proper mythology episodes we've had of late.
Yeah, well, Ghoulie, like I've said before, Ghoulie is actually a mythology episode. I mean, it's funny that, you know, Ghoulie is a monster of the week that ends up being a mythology, and My Struggle 4 is a mythology that ends up being a monster of the week. So they're kind of like bookends. Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's like again, I mean, I think that, you know, when you hear that kind of like really ear-scraping comic booky dialogue in Carter's scripts, my sense is that that's just a an indication that this is like, if not actually a first draft, then pretty damn close to it. Because when Carter works on a script, I mean, his dialogue is never perfect. It's always sort of got these like dissonant notes within it, but it's usually a lot better crafted. I mean, that's why I was just stunned by the difference between the writing in My Struggle 3 and Plus One. I mean, it was like two different writers as far as, you know, the snap and the cadence of it. So I don't know. I mean, I know he's, you know, he wants to go out there and sort of defend his work, but I don't think that he was like, you know, up by candlelight burning the midnight oil, you know, in some cabin up in the Sierra Mountains, you know, working all this out. I think that this was a lot more provisional and sort of last minute than he would like to admit.
But I mean, I felt like there was kind of a winking aspect of a dialogue here, which I didn't always feel was present in the previous struggles, you know. So like when Mulder's saying, like, I had some payback to pay back, or when Tad O'Malley's saying, like, you know, he's talking to Scully about the contagion and he says, like, did you say unleashed? You know, I'm sure we can't be meant to take this seriously, you know. It, like, you know, like, a million times more about comic books than I do, but, like, that's the kind of thing you can almost see a speech bubble around, you know. So I think if you accept that that's Carter's intention, which is the way I approach it, it goes down a lot easier is the way I perceive it anyway, you know?
Well, see, you know, it's one of these things where it takes one to know one, you know what I mean? You've got to sort of know the inside lingo. And when I, you know, Carter has denied, and he actually denied to me that he read comic books as a kid, and I just don't believe him. I just don't. I mean, you don't write a story like Patience if you haven't read Man Bat comics, you know? So I don't believe him. And his dialogue, you know, that's sort of that dialogue that people love to complain about is just, to me, it's just like classic 60s Stan Lee, 1970s Roy Thomas. I mean, it's a comic book. It's Marvel Comics dialogue. That's exactly what it is. You know, it's just kind of like that's his, you know, when he's rushed or he's, you know, he's under the gun, so on and so forth. That's what he lapses into. So as far as Unleashed, though, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's awkward wording. But at the same time, it's like, what does Unleashed mean? It means it's not a naturally occurring virus. It means somebody is releasing it into the ecosystem. I mean, I think released would probably be a better turn of phrase than unleashed. But, you know, there you go.
No, I'm not kind of knocking it. I'm saying that, like, I think it fits when you have an episode with, like, exploding heads and all that kind of thing, you know. Whereas in My Struggle 2, for example, you had, like, loads of stuff about alien DNA, but you also had scenes where Scully and Einstein stopped for 5 minutes and talked about, you know, whatever the hell it was they were talking about. You know, I didn't always feel it was an easy fit there. I do feel there is a fascinating episode, like, within My Struggle 2, kind of struggling to emerge. But here I felt it was more successful. Let's press on with a couple more comments. So, Caradwen Foley, again, this is just a partial message. She didn't think this was a very good episode. But she says, are we to believe that this global contagion for which all the plans have been laid won't go forward, that these bad guys hadn't made any contingency plans, that there are no second-in-commands coming? William's death wouldn't even keep anyone from pursuing him because none of the other bad guys know what happened, and they'd assume Mulder is lying to protect his son. I mean, I suppose all the contagion stuff, it is there if the story ever gets picked up in the future. But as things stand, I guess we can kind of just assume that, you know, all those plans are kind of in abeyance is kind of how I took it.
Well, do you want to know my interpretation?
Absolutely.
I think that basically what happened is that the whole global contagion story was written with the understanding that this 6-episode miniseries was just going to be a one-off. And that was going to be it for the X-Files. So it's so ironic that it really gets back to what Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong did with Millennium when they thought the series was going to be canceled. They're like, well, the series is going to be canceled. Let's just, you know, blow up the world and release the Marburg virus and so on and so forth. And, you know, Carter, you know, the entire X-Files mythology from very early on was about this whole idea of a global contagion being unleashed on the public. I mean, I'm blanking out at the moment is when that was actually first explored. I'm thinking maybe F. Emasculata, but yeah, maybe even before that. You know, just the whole idea that, you know, the syndicate, the conspiracy was planning to just basically wipe everyone out with a contagion. So I think it's just sort of like, well, you know, you wanted a contagion, you wanted to see, you know, all hell break loose. Well, here it is. And then it's like, oh, well, now we have to walk it back. So I think that I think it's just sort of like one of those, like, this is the reality of the television business. You know, it's just like, I think that, you know, we've been spoiled today by all these sort of serials and this kind of storytelling. And we tend to really overlook just how seat of the pants television was in the past, you know.
Yeah, well, I like the messiness personally, because, like, I can't really think of a good example, but some of these, like, Netflix series that come out and you get them all on the same day, they feel a bit airless to me, you know. Like you say, seat of the pants, I like that. I think it, I mean, up to a point, it can work in the series' favor, really.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like knowing what you're getting for Christmas, you know. It's like, it's just like peeking at your presents, so to speak. It's just, I mean, I love the first Stranger Things. I thought the second one was pretty awful, but, you know, a lot of these series that, you know, you have on Netflix, you know, since I tend to be very obsessive, I appreciate. But I also appreciate, like, this whole week-to-week thing. And just the fact that, like, I was just so dreading this episode with just, like, this sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. And I was just so pleasantly surprised. And I think so, and I'm just going to say this, I mean, you know, people can react to it however they please, but I think that so much of the reaction against this episode is just sort of prejudice. People had sort of readied their reaction. Oh, I'm going to hate this. This is this, that, and this and that. And they had been readying that for, you know, 2 years now or whatever. And, you know, it's just like, it just was sort of burned into their programming, because so many of the criticisms that I'm reading of it that are like, you know, they're just deal breakers are just, you know, just so trivial. I mean, I just don't get it. Or they just, you know, they're making criticisms of things that aren't really there. I think that what you really need to do with this episode is just sort of just sweep all that away and just watch it with just clear, unadulterated, unprejudiced eyes. because I think it's just brilliant writing. I think it's one of Carter's best scripts in since, I don't know, maybe existence, maybe, I don't know, maybe before. You know, I just think it's just, I think it's a fantastic piece of writing, but it's also a fantastic piece of Carter writing, which is just like incredibly fractal and expecting people to make all these little connections, you know, expecting people to read his mind and so on and so forth. You know, all these things that people were like really eager to do in 1996 on all TV X-Files, but just doesn't jibe with this very hyper literal, very hyper, like, tell me exactly what you mean kind of atmosphere of 2018.
Yeah, I'll get back to the comments in a sec, but I mean, this occurred to me when you were saying earlier about, like, you know, him ripping up the rule book or whatever, and like, as much as like the series has tried to modernize in some ways, this just reminded me of like the way series used to end in the 90s or in the 80s, I guess, where the final episode would just be kind of bananas, you know, in a way that doesn't seem to happen quite so much anymore. I can't really think of a good specific example, but I don't know. Do you think that's valid or not?
I kind of get the sense of what you're talking about. The problem is that I always just sort of think that very few series back in those days knew they were being canceled, you know, when they wrapped up filming. I mean, that's sort of like the whole idea of like, oh, you can do your series finale. That seems to be relatively recent and certainly very sporadic back in those days. I know what you mean, but I think that's maybe more of a 90s thing than an 80s thing. Actually.
I don't know if I was thinking, I haven't seen this series, but the one I always read about, I don't know if you watch this. Was it Saint Elsewhere? Do you find out the whole thing's like in a snow globe or something in the final episode?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. I did used to watch that show. I didn't watch that episode at that point in time. That was one of these Brandon Tartikoff projects that was, you know, it was very highly regarded but got very poor ratings. So I think that might be like a bit of an outlier in some regards.
I guess something like Seinfeld, I guess, where, you know, hey, the series is ending, let's put them all in jail or whatever. Something that kind of like sideswipes people, you know, takes people by surprise, what I was thinking anyway. You mentioned Carter's fractal nature, and so does Zach Moore, who he liked this episode. Here's part of what he said. He said, "This was the anti-My Struggle 2, micro instead of macro, wise decision. The X-Files always works better that way, rather than apocalyptic end-of-the-world stuff. The non-chronological storytelling was necessary to get everything in one episode, and I think it was handled well. If this is to be the end, Carter provided a satisfying finale, at least for the characters, if not for the series. But let's face it, there's never going to be a satisfying end for a series like The X-Files at this point." And, like, the non-chronological storytelling, the structure of this episode was really interesting, really strange, actually. The fact that you kind of pick up after the teaser and then you get a few scenes, don't you? The X-Files are closed, blah, 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 and then you circle back 15 hours later. The other thing I thought was interesting there was, like, when Mr. Y says, hey, we couldn't catch William, like, literally, and then the next scene, I couldn't work out if it was, like, if it had already happened or what, but, you know, the rooftop chase with William, like, the free-running action stuff, and, like, I think a few people have complained about this, but it sort of kind of arrests the forward flow of a narrative, doesn't it? And that scene just kind of exists as like pure spectacle, doesn't it? I think.
Well, you know, it again, getting back to this whole idea of revisiting, you know, greatest hits from the past, I think that what that reminded me of more than anything else was the scene in Herrenvoke when the alien bounty hunter is chasing Mulder and Jeremiah Smith through the boathouse. And I don't know if that was intentional on Carter's part. I have a feeling it might have been because of the dynamics of the you know, the character, you know, correspondences there. Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I hadn't watched the episode until it posted on Amazon because I just absolutely refused to watch commercials on television anymore. I was reading all these people saying all these different things about the show, and they're like, oh my God, you know, running and running and chasing and chasing, and it's like, I was just expecting it to just be like, you know, just one long chase scene, but it's like, it really wasn't. I mean, I think that there's a little bit too much emphasis played on that. And I think that might be because it's not usual X-Files storytelling, but to me, you know, complaining about the chases in that episode is sort of like complaining about the car chases in Bullet, you know, it's just like, kind of like, you don't get the point. You're missing the point here. And I think Bullet is kind of maybe a touchstone for Carter as well, because that's like, you know, hit him right square. And what, he was probably 12 years old when that movie came out. I mean, that must have been like Godhead to him. So anyway, I think that, as far as, you know, this new conspiracy that what I call the other smoking man and the other Diana Fowley.
Yeah.
I think that it's probably a lot larger. It isn't just these two people. I mean, these are the two people that contact Mulder, but I'm sure like that second chase was, I think, was clearly being orchestrated by her, because that's why we see her sort of follow up when the that was Joseph Patrick Finn, by the way, a longtime X-Files stalwart who got his head face blown off. You know, I think that chase was just being orchestrated by her. So, I mean, that didn't bother me. I just, you know, again, I love the fact that, you know, he sort of sets up these characters like bowling pins in the first episode of the series, which I thought was pretty uniformly horrible, by the way, and then just sort of knocks them down like bowling pins at the end here.
And I mean, for all that, you know, like we say, Worm's a monster, but he also functions as like, you know, kind of a Hitchcock MacGuffin. Like, everybody wants William. Why does it matter? I don't know. You just need to know that everybody's after him, and you sort of go for the ride, I think. And that's how I enjoyed this episode the most, I think. And yeah, just we'll just do a couple more, because I want to ask you about the season as a whole before we go. Li Zhu said, I liked some aspects of this finale and I disliked others. I liked Mulder fighting for his son, William finally meeting Mulder and not rejecting him at first sight, that all the villains are dead, that Scully is afraid for Mulder, their obvious complicity, that William talks to Scully and tells her that he knows she loves him, that Mulder kills CSM by himself, that Duchovny and Anderson play the last scene so well, that William is still alive, that a new baby is on his way. It's highly improbable regarding Scully's age, but why not? That they end together and kind of appeased, and I liked Monica's redemption, but I had no doubts on her being nice. I mean, Reyes, I mean, she's been pretty shortchanged, I think, by this these last few episodes. I mean, would you agree on that?
Yeah, but from what I heard, and I'm still trying to track down the sources, but she wasn't actually supposed to appear. It was actually supposed to be Laurie Holden, and as Marita Covarrubias, of course. And what Carter revealed recently is that cameo appearance by you know, Jeffrey Spender was actually supposed to be Doggett, which would have made a lot more sense in context of the story. But, of course, he was unavailable. So, I mean, again, this is the reality of television production. You know, people have schedules, and you can't, you know, it's not like a movie where you can maybe like, well, we'll wait until you're done and then we'll reschedule, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, you've got to get this done because it's going to go on the air at such and such a date. So I think with Monica Reyes, that I think that her motivations, I think, were pretty well spelled out in My Struggle Too, you know, such as it is, such as they are. You know, it's just basically a glorified cameo appearance by her. And it was just sort of like, you see, the funny thing is that, you know, we're seeing all this stuff in fandom. We're like, oh, my God, how can you do this to Monica? And it's like, wait a minute. Let's dial the clock back here, because all I ever remember reading back in 2001, 2002 is, oh, my God, we hate this character. Kill her. You know, burn it with fire. Why? You know, well, how can you possibly do this to us? This is the worst thing ever in the universe. Oh, my God, Annabeth Gish should just be like hung from a tree, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was just like one thing after another. And it's like, oh, all of a sudden, they, you know, it's like that. This is, you know, problems with fandom in general. But I think that, you know, it was just sort of Carter saying, you know, you were a good soldier and you put up with a lot of nonsense, and this, you know, you deserve a little screen time and you deserve to go out like a hero. So,
I mean, I'm glad that Chris Owens was the one brought back for just a single scene, because I'm such a Doggett fan that I don't think him just turning up for a line or two would have been particularly satisfying. Right, Lee, what she disliked, this is what she said. She said, I disliked William exploding villains, that William doesn't live with Mulder and Scully happily ever after, that CSM has created him, that Skinner and Reyes are maybe dead, and more than anything, that Scully erases William in a few minutes, even if she probably knows he's alive thanks to her visions and surely wants to protect Mulder. That makes no sense to me. And finally, for now, I think, like I say, I'll return to some of these messages on a future podcast, I think. But Lizzie says, I thought the episode did as good of a job as it could have with the limited amount of time it had to end the William storyline as best it could. I was entertained and I really loved how Mulder finally got to react in some way. The end scene was beautifully acted and done. I mean, she mentions the time it had. I mean, I'm really interested when the DVDs come out. I want to see what deleted scenes they include, because I can imagine there'd be some stuff left on the cutting room floor from something like this.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and it's just interesting because, you know, Carter really is, at this point in his career, is like, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, because I'm sure he would have liked to have had a lot more room to tell the story. And you can sort of sense from these My Struggle episodes that everything is just like super condensed and packed into like as little room as, you know, I mean, it's just so claustrophobic. It's like, you know, putting all your, laundry in a basket that's too small or something. I'm not exactly sure what the metaphor is there, but, but Carter, and he won't get any credit from this, from, you know, a lot of the fans, but he said he went to conventions and he talked to fans and they said they wanted to see more standalones and so on and so forth. So he basically shortchanged himself by front loading the mythology and back loading it at the end. And then just, you know, giving the fans what he thought they wanted. I mean, again, I think that this is probably a little bit of incomplete market research on his part, because I think that the overwhelming majority of fans outside of the conventions, outside of online and so on and so forth, would probably like to have seen this storyline fleshed out a lot more. And a matter of fact, when I talk to people about these, you know, people outside fandom, that's always what I hear. It's just sort of like, well, why did they just sort of like just dispense with this so quickly? And I think Carter was just sort of being influenced by, you know, too small a sample size in this regard. So I think that there's so little time that he allowed himself to resolve these storylines and so on and so forth, that the criticisms on the face of it are valid. I mean, you know, the criticism just based on the work themselves that the people are making as far as these My Struggle episodes are concerned are definitely valid. I think that the problem is here is that they're not taking into account the sort of the politics and the mechanics of putting these miniseries together. I'm sure Carter would have liked twice as many episodes to tell the story, but maybe at the same time he had enough to do already and didn't feel like stretching himself that thin. So who knows?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think we've touched on all the main points from My Struggle 4. Unless you can think of anything that deserves a bit more attention, Chris.
Well, I think, you know, Carter is sort of talking about the series continuing on, you know, and I think that might be like wishful thinking on his part, but I also think that he wants people to sort of, who hadn't been watching the series, to go back and watch it on iTunes and so on and so forth. I get the sense that what he was doing with this episode was giving Fox a spinoff, you know, what he saw as a viable spinoff using the X-Files universe, you know, because he knew well before this episode was filmed that Gillian Anderson wasn't going to be involved. I mean, Gillian Anderson, you know, is a very good actress. I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, she acted well here, but she didn't act like Scully. You know, I mean, it's not the Scully we recognize. And I think that, you know, is played a large part in her decision to leave, because it's like, you can't go back necessarily and rediscover who you were 20 years ago, 25 years ago when you were playing this character, because, you know, you've had so much different life experience and played so many different roles. You know, I mean, I really felt in the 10th series that she was basically playing her character from The Fall, just with, you know, a slightly less horrible British accent. So, you know, be that as may. I think that she was much better this season, this series, but I'm not exactly sure she was just entirely engaged the way she had been back, say, in the fourth or fifth seasons.
No, but like by contrast, I think David Duchovny has kind of really refound Mulder in a very interesting way.
Oh, brilliant, this series. Just wonderful. You know, we've talked a lot about how David sort of can phone it in when he's not, you know, engaged or interested in the material, and I think that he is really the MVP of this season. He just really stepped up, and, you know, particularly in an episode like Familiar, I just thought he was just absolutely fantastic in it, and also in Plus One, I just thought he was just he played those beats, sort of those old those old 50s kind of pillow talk movies beats really, really well. You know, he really did the whole Cary Grant role very well. So I think that he just did a great job. And, if there is to be a spinoff, I think he deserves to star in it. And, I think You know, the kid who played William was also very good. I mean, it's like it was the first voiceover in my memory that I just wasn't cringing over. I was like, oh my God, he's like reading the voiceover. Like he actually cares about what this kid is saying. And that's like such a, like, it's like, look at the contrast between the, you know, the earlier voiceovers and just voiceovers throughout this series. You know, it's like, you know, the great example is David sort of, you know, he's on his way out the door and they said, you know, before you go, can you read this existence voiceover? And he's like, listen, my limo's waiting for me. I've got a flight in 20 minutes. Well, just read it. You know, it's just like that's that kind of approach. So I was just like, oh my God, this is what a Chris Carter voiceover can sound like when somebody's just not like reading it with a gun pointed to their head. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, especially because it didn't lapse into like teenage idiom too much, I don't think, as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. When Carter is engaged, when Carter's like on his game, his dialogue can have like I said, it has like a few dissonant notes, but it's usually very clean. And to me, like the dissonant notes are sort of like, you know, those, you know, when they put like, you know, dog crap in perfume or something, a little tiny bit of it, just so like it just sort of like brings out the flowers more. That's like this whole perfumist's philosophy. I don't understand it, but you know, so be it. And that to me, it was like, you know, that's, but I just thought this, you know, there is this whole thing, you know, have you seen the internet? But this is like, put it in context. This is a guy who's like in his 60s, maybe his 70s. He's an FBI director. He probably doesn't spend a lot of time on the internet. You know what I'm saying? It's probably like it's like a foreign country to him. So I that didn't bother me. I mean, a lot of things that the people were bothered by, they're not placing in context necessarily.
Yeah, although Kirsch was pretty fond of his text messages to Skinner, which I thought was pretty funny with his overuse of exclamation points. But I know I thought in this package, you know, in this episode, it worked much better than I expected it would, honestly.
I'm always glad to see Kirsch, too, because the thing I really like about Kirsch is that Kirsch is like sort of painted as the villain, but that's not what he is at all. I mean, Kirsch is like he's the voice of reason. Like he's like, you know, like he's the sober minded adult in this whole mix of crazy overgrown children, you know?
Yeah, totally. Right. Final order of business for today, Chris. I mean, season 11, a very strong season, I think. And I remember talking to you when we were doing some Podwatch episodes, and there was a point when we were both like, oh man, I don't know about this season 11, you know, against all odds. It's been by and large pretty terrific. I think it kicked off with My Struggle 3 and dramatically improved afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my take. I mean, luckily Fox released like the first five episodes to critics and stuff. So I got to find out that this horrible train wreck of a season opener, you know, in the classic X-Files tradition, was not going to be, you know, the way the rest of the season was going to play out. Again, it's sort of like the kind of thing where like Carter just has this very producer sense that I've got to sort of set up all these characters. I've sort of got to set up all these story arcs and all this kind of thing. And, you know, he doesn't really have a track record of doing so artfully, but you know, the plot lines and the plot points that he sets up, you know, are later exploited to much better advantage by the other writers. And this, you know, right off the bat, we had this, which was just like, you know, Glenn Morgan kind of coming in and taking the ball and running with it and just doing a fantastic job. And then of course, Jim Wong in Ghouli just doing a tremendous job and doing again the same. See, I don't know, you know, I don't know where the fandom is going per se. I don't know how where serious fandom is going. I mean, I hope that, you know, Tony and you and Darren and people like that are still going to be sort of the locus point for serious X-Files fandom. So but in that regards, it's like I think that people should really look at the interplay between Chris Carter and Jim Wong's episodes and the way that they are reframing the entire X-Files mythology. I mean, and in Finder's Mutation, Jim Wong is saying, well, listen, all these characters, you know, these monsters of the week, it isn't just like some sort of happenstance that has nothing to do with the overall storyline. They are products of the overall storyline. They are the experiments. They are the failures. They are the test cases that escape from the lab, so to speak. They are part of this whole phenomenon. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And, I mean, I don't think it's a great episode insofar as structure and pacing, but I think that was just pure genius on his part. And to do it again with Ghouli and set it up for Chris, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's like set and point. It's like Jim Wong sets up this whole idea for Chris to sort of just like, you know, it's like the pass and the dunk, you know, and in Chris Carter's case, I mean, he just like says, all right, well, what, you know, Jim is saying here is that, you know, you can almost envision like the story meetings in, you know, the story conferences in this regard, because it's like, okay, well, you know, William is a monster and, you know, that's going to be sort of the denouement of the series. You know, it's like full circle back to the beginning, you know? I mean, it's like he's Billy Miles plus Toombs plus, you know, everyone you can mention, Donnie Faster even. I mean, he's just like, he's kind of like the culmination of all I mean, he's even like, you know, he's even Pusher in some regards. So, and plus he's a shapeshifter, and that's where the whole thing with this, the alien bounty hunters comes in, and, you know, Jeremiah Smith and even all the way back to the Kindred, you know, that the aliens can shapeshift. So he's got this, you know, super hyped up alien DNA, so he can shapeshift like plus 10, you know, and, you know, the whole thing where the people in infected with the black oil can just like incinerate somebody, you know, he can not only, you know, he can just like incinerate somebody to the point that they just explode. So, you know, again, all these little touch points that I'm hoping that people are going to just sort of go back and start to like pick through the rubble and find all the gems and sort of construct this narrative, you know?
Yeah. Well, in terms of gem, I don't know if it's a gem, but one line I forgot to mention earlier in the teaser when he says something like, I want no part in the suffering that's to come or something. And I liked that. And I liked that, you know, he scared the truck driver. He didn't, you know, the people he dispatched, by and large, deserved it, you know. But I suppose if the Jackson Vanderkamp show ever comes back, his powers might need to be a bit more strictly defined, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's the tradition of X-Files monsters. I mean, you know, X-Files monsters are never just monsters. You know, they're never just like, oh, I'm bad and I'm going to kill you. It's like they're always just like freaks that are trying to survive in like a harsh environment. You know, and we don't understand that, you know, to a Toombs or to the character in Tolico or to the character, you know, to Leonard Betts, that they're like characters trying to survive in an inordinately harsh and unrelentingly hostile environment. And I think that's sort of the subtext with, you know, Jackson, again, being a classic X-Files monster. A classic X-Files monster is not just like a killing machine. Classic X-Files monster is a creature that is, you know, adrift in a hostile world and is trying to survive.
Yeah, and I guess the chap in Hungary is a good example of that, isn't he, as well? Rob Roberts.
Absolutely.
All right, cool. Cheers, Chris. Always a pleasure. And people can check out what you're up to. I guess it's secretsun.blogspot.com. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's correct, yes.
Cool, and you're knocking about a bit on Twitter as well these days. And in terms of the X-Cast, I mean, we've got some interviews coming up with some of the writers and directors from the second half of the season, and they'll be coming soon. We've got a season 11 roundtable discussion episode as well. Then I think we'll be having a little break, and then we'll be back for season 3 coverage. In the meantime, it's all the usual places: Twitter at @X_cast, Facebook the X-Files Basement. Until next time though, listeners, trust no one.
The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXcast. That's PATREON. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at @IAmWillAye.